everybody. Welcome to the Jeff Rubin, Jeff Rubin Show. I am Jeff Rubin, and today we are talking to an artist whose work has been exhibited internationally in New York, LA, London, Milan, Hong Kong. You can find it in all sorts of public and private collections, including the Getty, Harvard Museum, and the Seoul Museum of Art. But today we are here to talk about his Kickstarter for Black 3.0, the blackest black paint in the world. Please, a big Jeff Rubin Show welcome for Stuart Semple. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
This project is something you can look at online, and I've looked at it online. I guess this is one where I'd encourage people to go and look at the Kickstarter to really see how black this black paint is. But I guess my first question for you is, I'm looking at it on the Kickstarter website. Is what I'm seeing online digitally, does that do it justice to what I would be seeing in real life? Just how black is this paint?
No, it's so much weirder in real life. You can't really photograph it, actually. But, yeah, I keep sort of looking at it in the studio, and it's just freakily black. I mean, it's just so dark. It's not like anything you've kind of seen before. It's really odd.
And I guess, like, what makes it different than the black paint, you know, if I just go to the corner art store and I buy some black paint? Like, what's different between that and what you are producing here?
Oh, it's so much different. I mean, most paints that you buy are reflective, you know, they're shining. Even the very best matte paints still reflect some light. What we've made is a black paint that absorbs almost all light. It's absorbing between 98 and 99% of visible light. So it's not so much a color, it's more an absence of light that you're actually seeing, which is a really odd effect.
So is it made of the same stuff that normal paint is made of, or is it a completely different chemical compound?
It's a completely new process, Jeff. We started from the ground up in developing it. So we actually made our own pigment from scratch in a lab. And the pigment we created, we call it Black Magic because it is absolutely a dead matte spherical pigment. And most black pigments actually out there are slightly reflective. If you think of charcoal or carbon, which is the most commonly used black pigment, they're slightly reflective. They're sort of shiny. And we created a new pigment. But not only that, we also created a new binder, a new acrylic resin to hold that pigment. And this binder is really special because it's got more available bonds than any other polymer out there, which means we can absolutely stuff loads of pigment in the paint, which means a really dense, ultra pigmented paint which traps loads and loads of light.
So what I'm trying to figure out about you, Stuart, is you're obviously a very busy artist, a very accomplished artist. Like, at what point is figuring out how to manufacture paint, is that part of your art? Is it like something you think of as like a secondary thing? Like, where does the manufacturing of actual art supplies, how does that fit into your general art career?
Well, it fits in a load of ways. I mean, I've always made my own paints. So for about 20 years, I've made my own paint to use in my work because I was kind of disappointed by the paints you could get in the art shops. They were just kind of a bit rubbish and not powerful enough. So I was making my own colors.
And can you help me? Like, I am not an artist, so I don't know that I understand. Like, what was unsatisfying about the paints you were buying at the art shop? They just weren't, like, vibrant enough? Like, what was it about them that, like, left you wanting?
Yeah, they weren't vibrant enough. They weren't opaque enough. I could see that the people who were making them were really sort of cheaping out and just not making great quality paint. And up until quite recently, artists made their own paints. It's what artists did. Artists made their own colors. Commercial paints only really came in the sort of Victorian era. So we've got the whole of art history, actually, where artists made their own colors. And I was always really inspired by that. I thought it was awesome, kind of the alchemy of it and everything. It was a big part of my work.
But, I mean, when you're talking about this paint, you're talking about polymers and bonding. Like, surely these are things you had to, like, that you must have had to learn something new to do this, right? Like, how do you, I mean, it's like when you talk about this, you don't sound like an artist, you sound like a scientist. So how did you begin to learn, like, what makes paint and what makes some paint good and what how to make a chemical that, like, did what you wanted it to do? How did you figure that out?
Well, I just kept hitting hurdles, you know. I kept trying to make it do something, and then I'd realize I didn't know how to do it, and then I had to go and find out. And I reached out to people who knew more than me. And I mean, we're very lucky that we've got the internet now, and you can find out almost anything about anything. And over the last couple of years, my paint making's grown, and people are starting to use these materials, other artists. So I've actually been able to take on a full-time research scientist in my studio. So I'm making art in one corner, and she's solving these crazy problems I have in the other corner. And it's just beautiful to see art and science kind of colliding like this. It's amazing.
You have produced some other, you've manufactured, I guess I should say, some other products that are all sound sort of interesting. These are just the ones you mentioned in the Kickstarter video for the black paint. But you also made the world's most potent light-emitting pigment powder. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's called Lit.
What is that? What I don't even know what pigment powder is. So this is like something you would use to make more paint?
Yeah, you can make your own paint. So you could mix it into a resin, or you could mix it into your own paint, because I want to create materials that are very open source that artists can use to make their own things out of, you know. So anyway, back to the pigment powder, the Lit. It glows for 12 hours, but the stuff's so bright, it kind of glows in almost dull daylight. It's a bit like when you were a kid, you know, maybe you had those stars on the ceiling of your bedroom and they lit up, they glowed in the dark, like that. But imagine if you made that 100 times better. That's basically what this stuff is.
And what did you like use that for? What are some of like the notable projects that people have made with that?
There's been so much crazy stuff. I mean, one guy the other week did this whole floor of his house. He mixed it into varnish and painted the whole downstairs of his house.
That's weird.
But other people are using it for like road markings in developing countries, which is really interesting. I never thought they'd do that. Great sculptures. People are using it on their paintings. People are making jewelry out of it. All sorts of stuff.
And is that something you still produce? Like, could I go buy that if I wanted to now to, you know, say, paint my entire floor?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You can just go on the website, order it. It will come. You can use it. Yeah.
And then some other products you've made are the world's first not-for-profit watercolor palette. What was that one?
Yeah, so basically, as I said before, I've got this problem with how greedy all these paint manufacturers are. And I realized a lot of artists struggle to be able to afford good materials. And one of the things that all artists need for art school is just a good watercolor palette. But good professional palettes cost about £110. It's like $150, you know, and a lot of people can't do that. So I wanted to create a not-for-profit watercolor palette that had the best pigments and the best binders. And we managed to do that for less than $50 a set. And we disseminate those to artists for what it costs us to make them. And I think that's a really beautiful thing to be able to do.
That's lovely. And then this one last project I got to ask you about, because this is maybe the most brilliant idea of all, compostable glitter. Compostable glitter. What is compostable glitter made out of?
It's actually made out of eucalyptus resin, which is left over from when they make essential oils. So it's a waste product from that. So it's basically plant cellulose, because the problem you've got with glitter is it is the worst microplastic out. And before you know it, it gets into the soil, it gets into the rivers, it gets into the fish. Microplastics are the worst thing for our bodies and the environment. And I wanted to do something about glitter, because here in the UK, all the schools have banned glitter. The music festivals are banning glitter. And I couldn't bear to think of a future where artists couldn't have glitter to make work with. So we set about making this beautiful, compostable, biodegradable eco glitter called Dazzle.
So this is not the first time you've sort of had an interesting new idea for a product and mass manufactured it and sold it to a lot of people. But is Black 3.0 the largest project that you've undertaken to produce something like this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just a completely different level. I mean, the science involved, the chemistry, and also the materials that we've been talking about. We actually pretty much make them in my studio ourselves. I have a small team of paint makers, and we do our best to make enough materials to go around. But Black 3, there was no way we could afford to produce it, you know, because of the equipment needed and that kind of thing. And we also knew there'd be quite a big demand for it. So That's why we decided to turn to Kickstarter to help fund the production of that for all the artists that needed it.
And this is this the first Kickstarter you've run?
All those I've never done it before.
And I mean, you're already spoiler alert, you're already extremely well funded. I think you're at like something like 550,000 on your goal of 32,000. Are you surprised that it's been so successful on Kickstarter?
Yeah, I had no idea what would happen. I thought it would take, you know, I think we ran it for 60 days, and I thought it would take that long to maybe get up to the $30,000. And I couldn't believe it. You know, within a couple of days, we'd hit our target. I honestly didn't think people cared that much about black paint, but it seems they do.
Why? Let me ask you, like, why has no one ever done this before? Is it because people don't think anyone cares about black paint? Like, how come, I don't know, I don't even know who the big manufacturer in paint is, but like, why has no one done this before? Like, why hasn't like a big, stupid American paint company mass manufacture this at like a giant level? Like, is it just that no one's had the idea? Is it just that people didn't think there was a demand? Like, surely people have studied black paint for a while, right?
Yeah, well, they don't. First of all, they don't think there's a demand. Second of all their equipment is set up to make paint in a completely different way. We literally had to force the factory that we're working with to break all the rules in how to mix it. It's not very economically viable if your business model is selling water with a little bit of pigment in it, actually, to be this generous. They'd have to sell it for so much money. The other thing is, the other paint companies, they sell through stores, you know, and we distribute direct to artists, so we don't have to mark things up and make them stupidly expensive. So to create a paint of this quality, if they were going to retail it through the model they have now, you'd be paying $100 for a small bottle of the stuff. So it's not really worth it for them.
What is like the pledge I have to put in on Kickstarter to get, you know, a bottle of it?
I think it starts at about $30.
That seems pretty reasonable to me, someone who hasn't bought paint since grade school or whatever.
Yeah, but it goes really far as well, because it's good quality paint. It's almost, you know, really, it will last. It's quite a lot of paint. But yeah, and the other thing is, there are people exploring very black substances, but more for like aerospace and blocking out stray light in telescopes and that kind of thing. And about 2-3 years ago, a company made the blackest black ever, which was called Vanta Black, which was made out of these weird carbon nanotubes. But they signed an exclusive agreement with this artist called Anish Kapoor. So he was the only artist that could use this amazing black. And what happened then was, the art community was so upset, and they really wanted to use a black. And that's kind of when I started to become aware of the potential to make a super black.
So they just licensed it to him exclusively, I guess, out of some sort of money thing? Like, he, you know, is that right?
Like, I guess so. I mean, we don't know the details of the deal, but he's the only artist that can use Vanta Black.
Sorry, and Vanta Black's like a patented substance. Like, you're not making Vanta Black. You're making a different black paint using a different process.
Yeah, completely different process, completely different way. Their process, you need to apply it in a science lab. You grow these nanotubes on a substance in a vacuum chamber. It goes up to like 600 degrees. It's extremely expensive. I mean, they'll work with a car manufacturer or a jewelry company, but they just will not talk to artists apart from Anish Kapoor, which really upset everyone.
And you kind of have like a cheeky joke about this on your website, how like, you know, when you're buying this, you are testifying that you are not Anish Kapoor and that you are not going to give it to Anish Kapoor, and just sort of like ribbing him a little for it. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, what happened was, after he got the rights to the Blackest Black, I put the Pinkest Pink on my website. And I said anyone could buy it apart from him. And you had to agree to this legal disclaimer that you weren't Anish Kapoor and you weren't going to share it with him.
Now, what makes a pink a pinkest pink? Because black, I get that we can quantify it by how little light is being reflected out. But what makes your pink the pinkest pink?
It's flipping pink. I mean, that's the only thing I can say. Like, you've never seen anything this pink, and no one has. Like, tens of thousands of artists have used it, and no one has ever told me they've seen a pinker pink.
What is it made of? What is the pinkest pink substance that drives the pink paint? Pink panther blood?
No, but things that emit light, basically, and bounce off each other. It's a fluorescent pigment, but it's a really powerful one. But anyway, we banned him from buying the pink, and then he got some, and he dipped his middle finger in it and put it on Instagram, and it was really rude, and then everyone got really upset, and then they said I had to make a black to defeat him, which is when I started really going for the black.
Well, it is crazy that you have, you do seem, I mean, it does seem like this artist who is a really big artist, worked with what I'm assuming is a really big company with a really big R&D division to make this like really unique material. And it does seem like you've made a more accessible, cheaper version of it. I guess it took you three tries. Or what was the difference between, what changed between black 1.0, black 2.0, and what we're currently looking at, black 3.0?
Okay. Well, black one was a pigment powder and a base. And we sent that out to loads of artists for feedback. It was almost a beta version. And everybody told me how to make it better. And then black two is the paint we currently have, which is an awesome black paint. It's very flat. It's extremely matte. And it absorbs 96% of light. But it's not perfect. It wasn't as black as I wanted it visually, you know. Like in a science lab, you can measure it and it absorbs loads of light. But visually, it didn't have that rich blackness that you really want to see. And I was disappointed with it. And now with black 3, we're seeing it absorb between 98 and 99% of light. And it has that real depth of black color. It's almost like a velvet black in a bottle. So it's the ultimate, I think.
What did you do between 2 and 3? Like, what got you that last 2% that finally made you satisfied with the product?
Brilliant question. So in 2, we were using a pigment that had a glossiness to it. It reflected light. So that meant we had to add mattifiers to the paint to stop it reflecting light. And those mattifiers added a little bit of whiteness. And white and black obviously makes grey. So we got a slight grey tinge. So we created our whole new pigment from scratch, which was matte to start with, which meant we didn't need to add those mattifiers anymore, which meant we could have a much purer color. And that's what nailed it.
How much of your time, like day to day, week to week, are you spending like creating art? And then how much of your time are you spending kind of in the science lab messing with chemical compounds? Or is it all one thing in your mind and you can't clearly separate the two?
It kind of all feels like art. You know, even the science stuff is really creative. It's just kind of different materials. So it's hard to say. I mean, it's probably about 50-50 time-wise, really, at the moment.
Are there any other art supplies you've bought? Are there any, I guess I'm wondering, are there any other artists who produce kind of unique and interesting and unusual art supplies like the kind you produce, and you've bought them from them and you've used them, or you're aware that they're out there?
No, not that I've seen. It's not really very common for artists to kind of make and then share their supplies. I've never really seen anybody doing it. I mean, Bob Ross has a range of paint, but
that seems different, you know, to me. Kind of,
Yeah, that's kind of it.
Right. So this is really like a new type of thing you're doing. Like, I guess, are you at this point more well-known, and I don't know if you are able to answer this, but are you more well-known as an artist or as an art supply manufacturer? Or again, are they tied together?
I don't know. I don't really have a concept of it, because I'm just kind of in my studio making stuff.
Yeah, would one bother you? Would it bother you if you were known more as one than the other?
No, not really. I mean, when I do my art world things, my gallery shows, that seems okay. And then online, I certainly think online I'm much better known for the materials. And I think that's beautiful, because I've met such a lovely creative community. I mean, honestly, the audience we have, they're so incredible. I mean, look at the support on the Kickstarter. It's just mind-blowing.
I guess there must be people also who come to your art by learning about your work through the art supplies and vice versa too, right?
You'd be surprised. That doesn't really happen. Maybe a little bit, but it seems to me that people are either interested in the materials or they're interested in the work, the artwork. Mm. It's weird.
Have you made anything with Black 3.0 yet, or are you still focused on producing it?
Well, this is a bit top secret, but I've just finished a sculpture actually that I'm gonna unveil on Monday that uses Black 3, and that'll be the first kind of artwork that's been made with it.
And this, I think this is going to come out on Tuesday. So actually, that thing will be that sculpture will be up already. Where can people go see that?
You can see it in Covent Garden in Neal Street. It'll be on for a week, and it's free. So come and have a look.
All right, podcast listeners, get on an airplane and get to London.
Yeah, sorry, bit of a try.
You've still got some time left in the episode. We might still be talking when you arrive there. Is there any way? But if we're not in London, is there any way to see it online? I don't know how it works.
I'll just put it on my Instagram. There'll be pictures on my Instagram and Facebook and stuff.
And have other people, in the same way that people were doing unexpected things with the light emitting pigment, were people doing unexpected things with this light, capturing pigment?
I don't know. I mean, they haven't really got it yet. But Black 2, yeah, you just, everything you can think of has been done with it. Every weird idea under the sun.
What was like the most unexpected one to you that like you couldn't believe someone was doing with it?
Oh, someone made the obelisk out of, is it 2012 A Space Odyssey or something? I don't really know. I'm not really much of a sci-fi head, but they made this giant...
The monolith. I think we're talking about the monolith. It's like a big domino. It's like a rectangle from 2001.
Someone went and made that with it. It's huge.
That's perfect because that is like one of the most iconic, completely solid black objects I can think of, you know?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the film, which is probably terrible, but someone made that. I thought that was really cool when I saw an image of that thing. But all sorts of work, you know, great paintings with it, sculptures, all sorts of stuff.
It must be so gratifying to see, I'm sure it's gratifying to produce art and for people to enjoy that art, but then what you're doing now, like you're sort of enabling people to do it at scale. Like there's hundreds of pieces, some you'll probably never even find out about that, like couldn't have existed without the work you're doing there. Do you feel that at all? Is that satisfying?
It's really satisfying. It's almost like infuriating when I go back to make my art because it's never going to resonate in that way. And it's not going to enable people to make stuff and inspire other people to be creative in the same way, you know? So the materials feel, I don't know, it feels really special to be able to contribute them, quite honestly. Yeah, it's a different thing. I mean, it's a real pleasure doing it.
Now, where is it at? Like, when does the factory turn on? When does it start getting produced and squirted into bottles?
More or less as soon as the Kickstarter ends, really.
A week. If you're listening to this, there's still time to get on the Kickstarter and get a bottle of this.
Yeah, you've got about a week. And then the factory's ready. We had a test batch back today. It looks absolutely amazing. They're ready to switch it on. And then we'll make the bottles and we'll send them out to everyone. And then hopefully around about September time, we'll be able to have it properly on sale on the website. So it'd be a little gap between the two because we've got such a big volume of Kickstarter pledges to look after. We're going to get that out of the way first and then focus on...
vision is that this is like an ongoing product that you know, if someone's listening to the year, they should be able to buy it from your website.
Oh, 100%, yeah. After September, it'll be on the site, and you can get it whenever you want.
Right. I get, like, is it patented? Is this, like, is the process, like, something you own that cannot be replicated otherwise? I don't know exactly how that works in the UK, but is it something like that?
No, because, we just made it. Presumably, someone could try and copy it, but... The amount of work that goes into it. I mean, good luck to them if they're going to try and make that thing, because, no. I just don't think anyone... Well, they might work it out, but, fair play if they do. It's fine.
It's interesting that in the same way that people were using your light pigment in, like, sort of unexpected ways, like safety... do you think, like, I guess this dark pigment probably has other uses too? Like, you already mentioned telescopes and that sort of thing. Have you gotten any feedback about that?
Yeah, I've had quite a few people writing in. Photographers are very interested in it to paint inside their camera lenses and things to stop stray light.
Whoa, I don't even know what that means. Like, you open up, there's stray light, and you want to paint the inside of the lens to stop, I guess, stray light, a phrase I've never heard before, from bouncing around. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big thing for them. photographers.
What is the current solution to that? Like, I guess it's a less good black paint.
Yeah, 100%. Or an extremely expensive coating or a very, very expensive lens. So the other people who are very interested in it are amateur astronomers, because stray light's a big deal for them. If you're looking into space with a telescope and you've got stray light bouncing about, you don't get as clear an image and you can't see as far. So amateur astronomers can actually pay, you know, $30 and paint the inside of their telescope, and now they have an awesome telescope that can see way further. Which is just amazing. Like, I had no idea it could be used for something like that.
Yeah, I think
so. That's cool.
Yeah, I think that it's a sign that you're really onto something when people are using it not only for the intended use, but also come up with like other uses of it. It's like a sign that you've like really filled a need here. You've created something very useful. How many people did work on this? Like, how many people is Team Stewart?
Well, me and Jemima's the scientist, we pretty much worked on it. And then in my studio, we have four people who help make paint, but that's the other stuff. And then my friend Emily Morris helped me with all the graphics and the packaging and stuff. And then there was a guy at the paint factory we spoke to quite a lot. So that's it, really.
Yeah, so it's a pretty small team.
Small.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that, that's just for the paint. Do these people also help you with like your, you know, your art stuff?
No. That's different. I have other things there.
That's a different team.
Yeah. Yep.
So, but it's interesting because I think we think, I just don't know much about how artists work. So I guess I think we think artists is like often as like solo, you know, you're an artist and you're in your studio sculpting with like, you know, the palette on your arm. You're doing both painting and sculpting in my imagination, but it's actually like a team effort. And like, what do people help you out with to like enable you to do all these things?
Well, I mean, on the art side, I just did a huge city project in Denver, Colorado. And a lot of those were big public sculptural pieces. So one of them is a giant smiley face that's wedged in an alleyway between two buildings. I mean, this thing is like, I don't know, 15 foot by 15 foot, maybe more. So you need engineers for that. You need structural stuff that could land on someone's head and kill them. You've got to get it right. You've got the elements, you know. So these big public artworks need quite big teams to kind of execute them and project manage those sorts of things. And then the exhibitions that I do, I mean, we have whole teams on those as well, you know, to install it and, you know, do everything.
It's interesting because, okay, so you're an artist, you're a scientist, but also you're kind of a manager, right? Like this is another piece of your job is you got to like keep 10 people or however many people like kind of moving in the same direction and help, you know, running Stewart Incorporated, right?
Yeah, there is a lot of that, but it doesn't kind of feel like kind of boss employee kind of thing. It does feel like we're a group of friends who are kind of like doing it together, and it just happens to kind of have my name on it, but it really feels like it belongs to all of us, you know.
Right.
But you're right, there is a bit of that, and there's a bit of almost being an art director to it as well, you know, looking across lots of different projects and making sure they're moving in the right direction and making sure they still got the integrity of the work I want to put out, you know?
I don't know the exact hypothetical that's going to force you into this decision, but if you could only be involved in sort of developing new materials and selling those or producing your own art, do you have an instinct about which one you would rather be doing for the rest of your life?
I'd make art.
There it is.
100%. 100%.
Well, I guess good thing you don't have to choose then.
Yeah, no, but it would be hard. But don't
forget, it's more freedom, you said?
Yeah, because you can do anything in art, and in materials you're quite restricted. But the thing is, the interesting thing is, before kind of the Enlightenment, artists were scientists. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci was making flying machines and painting the Mona Lisa, and this is normal. It's only recently that creativity is creativity. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're coming up with science or coming up with a sky. It's all the same part of your brain. I don't get this distinction people are making. It's weird to me.
So can you help me understand how creativity, like, what's a moment in the development of this paint where, like, there was a challenge and you guys weren't sure how to overcome it and, like, someone applied some creativity and that solved the problem? Like, how do you use it in these more, I don't know, in a more scientific process?
Yeah, well, I mean, you get flashes of inspiration. You know, when you make anything, whether it's a painting or whatever it is, you hit a wall, you always do, and you don't know how to finish it, and you get stuck. And that happened with Black 3 loads of times. I can't even remember how many times. You know, we thought we had it. We were working with this science lab in Dallas, and they produced a pigment for us, and we were waiting ages for it to come, and then it came, and we tried it, and we mixed it into the polymer, and it just didn't work. And then one morning I came in, I just had this flash of inspiration. I was like, hang on, wait, what if we do it, you know, in this different way? And I explained it to Jemima, and I'm so lucky that Jemima is a very creative thinker. She's not like a normal kind of science person, and she can translate my arty brain into science. And together we managed to kind of like get over that.
What is Jemima's background? Does she have any art in her background, or is she a scientist who, like, saw an interesting job posting one day?
Yeah, so she's interesting because she's a forensic scientist.
Oh.
No, what does
that
mean?
You say that, and I imagine CSI. What is it a forensic scientist
basically. She trained in that. So the interesting thing about forensics is it straddles biology, chemistry, and physics. And it's about researching and finding out how to solve a problem. How did it get here? How does it work? What's the story? So she's perfect at picking things apart, working out what they mean, thinking creatively and scientifically about problems. And that's why she's perfect to work with.
Were you good at science in school? Like, were you good at, like, you know, high school biology? Or is it only something that's interesting to you because you're able to do it and pursue some, like, these specific challenges that you're, like, genuinely really passionate about solving?
Well, it was weird because I was good at lots at school. I was in all the top sets, and I was in sort of quite clever, maybe you'd say. And the problem I had was my passion was art. But I was getting such good grades. The world around me wanted me to be a doctor. And I rejected all of that. And I literally ran away to art school, despite my mum's wishes, you know. And interestingly, the science kicked back in. And because it became useful. There was a reason for it. I wanted to make stuff. And that reinvigorated my love for it, I think.
So this is the idea that you were into science, like that you were good at science, has always sort of been there. Like, it wasn't a surprise later in life. Like, it's something you had some background in. I'd love to hear more about what running away to art school. What exactly does that mean? What does that look like?
What that looks like is in England, we have these tests called the SAT tests. And I think you do them when you're about 14. And I did these tests, and I came out top in the whole county. So out of thousands and thousands and thousands of kids, I got the whole paper right. So they basically are like, you're some kind of genius. And they wanted to enroll me into the whole Mensa thing and everything. And I wanted nothing to do with any of that. It completely freaked me out. And I completely shut down and shut myself in my bedroom, listened to punk rock and started drawing and painting. And
what kind of punk rock are you listening to? I want to know what kind of disaffected British youth, what kind of punk rock are we
listening to? Sex Pistols, Buzzcocks, you know.
Excellent,
that
excellent.
Kind of stuff. Anyway, so I was listening to punk rock, painting pictures in my bedroom, didn't want anything to do with it. It all seemed deeply uncool to me as a teenager. And then it was time to go to college, which we do when we're 16 in England. And I was enrolled for four heavy academic subjects. And my mum agreed I could do art on the side, which was like 3 or 4 hours a week over at the art college. And what happened was I started going over to the art college to do my art classes. And I was really jealous of the kids that were there full time. So I actually made a little desk in the corner and stayed there. I didn't go back to the other college. I wasn't even enrolled. And I stayed there. And after about 6 months, the head of the department came over and he's like, Stuart, you're not enrolled. You can't actually be here. And I was like, look, I've got to be here. This is like everything to me. And he called my mum in and everything. And he was brilliant because he was like, you know, Stuart's quite good at this and we think he belongs here. And he really fought my corner. And I managed to stay there. And I left with a distinction, which was a big deal, and carried on making my work.
Do you remember, like, as a young kid, like, what was it about art that made you made it so clear to you that it was something you wanted to do, even though you obviously had like other opportunities. It seems like you could have done whatever you wanted. Like, do you remember, like, was there an artist or a museum or like a day where you really like zeroed in and like this became your thing?
Yeah, like when I was 8, my mum took me to the National Gallery in London and I saw Van Gogh's sunflowers at the end of this gallery. And it just did something to my head. Like I fell in love with it. It was like a rapturous kind of weird sort of religious, I don't even know. And I just knew that I wanted to make art. I wanted to be an artist. But I didn't even know what that was because I was only like 8 years old. But it just stuck in my, I mean, I can still see it now as if it's still there, just burnt in my head.
So now that you're older, do you have any insight into what it was about it? Because most eight-year-olds are not terrific at engaging with paintings, or at least I wasn't anyway. So like, do you remember like what it was that appealed to you about it?
It was the colors. It was the colors. And I now know that they were made out of really rich, hyperpigmented cadmiums. And that's what I saw. You don't see colors like that. You can't reproduce it in a book. Up until the age of 8, I'd only see books and album covers. I hadn't seen real pigments like that, you know, like a color like that.
So the colors on Van Gogh's sunflowers, and I guess in some of Van Gogh's other paintings, I couldn't reprint them in a book. Like a print wouldn't do it justice. The only way to really see the colors is to see the painting.
100%, because print in a book is made out of CMYK dots and a screen is made out of red, green and blue dots, and real pigments from the earth are actually that color. They're not made up of other colors. You're right. Seeing pure color, and it blows your mind when you see good color.
Have you done any research into, like, you know, the historically what this artist used, what that artist used? Like, it sounds like you have. I don't know if that's just because this is seminal painting for you.
No.
So what did you learn there? Like, what's an artist, like, what are some interesting tricks that artists have used over the centuries to like develop their color palettes?
Oh, I don't even know where to start. I mean, brown, the first browns were made out of ground up mummies. So mummy brown was actually made out of Egyptian mummies. And then we had lapis lazuli blue. And there's extinct pigments now that you can no longer get. And what we're working on in the studio right now is resurrecting some of these colors that have been forgotten in history. I actually want to bring them back so we can start using them again in new ways. That's my big project at the moment.
That's so, like, you're going to paint something today with historical materials.
We're going to bring back the colors that they would have used in historic times, but we're going to reinvigorate them for the 21st century because the paint technology is better now. So we're going to make them so much more usable and way more accessible. So we're going to bring back those very precious colors that artists haven't been able to use for hundreds of years.
Yet another interesting thing about you, Stuart, is, you know, we've mostly been talking about sort of traditional art and painting, but you also have at least some history with digital. And I have to ask you about this note on your Wikipedia page, which I don't know much about, so maybe you can explain this to me. But your Wikipedia page mentions that you were one of the first artists to really make use of eBay as an online community. And I'm always interested in, like, early internet Wild West history, particularly eBay, I think is like a really fascinating thing, is like the start of e-commerce. And I'm curious what your experience was there and like what you were finding and when this was.
Yeah, let's go there. So it's 1999. I'm in my dorm room at university. I've got a Nokia phone that's like a brick that I'm paying pay as you go. And it's plugged into my laptop, which is a Dell.
That's pretty cutting edge.
By a wire, and I'm making art, 3 pictures a day, because I actually had an anxiety disorder, and it's my way of coping, and I wanted to share these images with the world. And the only place I could find to actually upload an image and share it, because there was no Facebook, there was no blogs, there was nothing, was eBay. And I started putting 3 of these pictures a day up on eBay. And by the time I was 21, I'd sold 3,000 of them. And I had collectors all over the world who became my friends. And I realized that there's a community online that we can connect over ideas. And I actually managed to pay my rent like that. I became a professional artist the day I put my first work on eBay, which sold for £2.
So you were just selling your art on eBay. You're an unknown art student, you know, like you have no prestige or whatever yet. But I guess probably no one, I mean, this is like a novel idea. I think in 1999, everyone's like scratching their heads and looking at eBay and trying to figure out what they can sell with it. And you had the idea to sell art, which is a great idea because it's pretty easy to ship, you know, I imagine, right? And So you found, I mean, how did people, do you know how people like found your art on eBay? Were they looking for
you
art?
Won't believe it. Mate, there was no one else selling art on eBay. It was so early. Like there was like three people doing it. The category had no art in it. It wasn't like it is now. And the sort of people who were on eBay, I mean, there weren't many. It was we're talking really early doors here.
At this time, people are still like skeptical about putting their credit card number into something online. You know, like
that was huge, yeah. And PayPal hadn't won anyone's trust at that point. I mean, I still have people not knowing the difference between the internet and email. You know, like that's right. How basic the web was. It was. You can't imagine. So literally, yeah, you could put it up there. And if someone was browsing eBay and they liked it and they wanted it for their house, they would give you $50 for it, you know? People were shopping.
How long did you... And they were like, oh, look at this. I'll buy a picture on the internet. And like, that's a huge novelty that they get to explain to all their friends. How long did you do that for?
For 3 years.
And you sold, you said several thousand paintings, I think?
3,000, yeah.
That's insane. You sold 3,000 paintings over 3 years on eBay. Are you still in touch with any of those people? Do you have any sense if any of them have like followed your work?
Yes, I'm still in touch with some of them. And a beautiful thing happened in, when was it? A few years ago, 10 years after eBay. They actually put an exhibition together in London of them, and all the collectors got together and they assembled about 200 of these paintings that I'd made and framed them all. And they had an exhibition and it was amazing.
And then are there any other like digital platforms? I mean, now we've got a Kickstarter store, we've got an eBay store. Are there any other platforms you've found particularly interesting over the years?
I've made some bits for iTunes, just experimenting, but it didn't really work.
Like music?
No, it was like an art EP, so it had like a comic and video content, and it was kind of interactive, but no one really understood it. I think I was a bit early, and I should have really made an app instead.
Yeah, when you're describing it, it sounds like an app. Yeah. But an art app, that's an interesting idea. I guess I can think of some games that are primarily like are more art than game, but like an app that is an aesthetic artistic experience, that could be something interesting. I don't know that I've seen something like that. Have you?
Could be. No, I think there's a couple of things, but I haven't really seen good ones. But one thing I did do is I made some websites which are artworks. There's one called andyfor15minutes.co.uk, and these websites that are just pure art, and I auctioned them on eBay, and I thought that was a cool idea to like sell the internet on the internet to the internet. I made like 10 of those, kind of these weird websites, and people bought them. They bid for the website, and then I gave them the domain certificate, you know, and that's what they actually got. And then, that was kind of a weird idea, conceptual.
I've got a really boring question, considering all the things we've talked about, but I want to understand. Like, what kind of hours do you work? Like, when are you? Do you get work this 9 to 5? Is it like all day? Like, how? Because it sounds like you're doing all these different projects. They're very self driven. You can kind of do as much or as little of them as you want. Like, how do you organize your day? Like, do you have a work day where it's like this is the time where I'm working?
Yeah, I start from 10 and I finish at 7. 10 a.m. till 7 p.m., 6 days a week. I have Saturdays off.
And then at 7 p.m., are you actually done? Like, are you good at disconnecting? Or
not at the moment, because I write back to all the Kickstarter comments and make sure
currently in a push, I would say, you know, with the end of the Kickstarter coming up.
Yeah, but I do kind of like writing back on Facebook to everyone. And, you know, I think the thing now I've got the phone, it's like you're always kind of at work with the phone. But I try and find time in the evening to like unwind, and I do my morning routine and stuff before work. So,
do you have any like other sort of projects, any products that you're sort of tinkering with? Maybe a whitest white, a yellowest yellow. Yeah. You know, I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah. So it's going to be, I don't know whether to call it the lightest white or the brightest white, but we're working on a white that reflects loads of light. We're working on different coloured lit. I can't tell you. There's one really big thing that I can't tell you about, but it's a real big game changer. I'm trying to make plant-based acrylic paints rather than plastic-based acrylic paints. Loads of stuff. Massive list.
And when you're thinking about how to make the lightest white paint. Is it like in any way, is the process at all going to be like making the blackest black paint, or is it the opposite process? Like, will you need a completely different solution?
It's going to be completely different. It's annoying. It's harder than you think because there are really good whites out there already, because all the interior decorating companies are making great walls, and we've got good white cars. Like, white is good. You know, there's a lot of good white. The competition's high.
Right, right, right. So that was a higher degree of difficulty, but it's something you're cracking on. And then all at the same time, you're also producing new shows. Are there any like upcoming exhibitions or shows besides the one sculpture we already talked about that people should be aware of?
Yeah, I'm getting ready for a painting show in London at the end of the year. Another city project, probably in Philadelphia, and then one in Hong Kong. And what else am I doing?
Do you have a favorite city? It's fun that you've shown stuff in all these cool international cities. Do you have like a favorite city to show in?
I liked Denver. I liked the atmosphere in Denver.
Yeah, Denver's cool. Colorado's great.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I mean, LA I like, but then I get bored of it. Like, after a couple of weeks, I just kind of want to come home. But London, like, you can't beat London. It's just, it's London. It's home.
And, you know, something I think we've neglected to do this entire time is, like, tell people how to find the Kickstarter. I mean, I'm sure if you Google Kickstarter blackest paint, you're going to find it. But what is the official name? Yeah. What is the link?
I don't know the link. But if you go on Kickstarter and type black 3.0, then you'll see it.
And what about your website, your Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff? How do I find that?
Yeah, so my Instagram's just @StuartSemple. My Twitter's @StuartSemple. My website's StuartSemple.com. And all the art materials are on CultureHustle.com, which is the website for them.
And if you're listening to this, you know, pretty close to the release date, like I said, I think you still have time to get on that Kickstarter. So go check it out. Stuart, I love what you're doing. It's like an interesting thing.
Thank you.
I mean, the actual work is very interesting, the way it combines art and science. But then you're also harnessing it to really positive effects, you know, helping make art supplies more accessible, helping the environment. Like, this is some really cool stuff you're doing over there. And I encourage people to go check it out.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.